Eddie Perfect, thanks so much for coming in this morning. It's really nice to have you back in the building with us.
Well, it's nice to be here.
And Dean Bryant, Associate Director at MTC, thanks for joining us as well.
Here all the time, thank you.
So we're here to talk about your new play, Eddie, Vivid White, which is being directed by Dean and will close MTC's 2017 season. However, I'd like to throw your minds back and ask, when did you first meet?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I've been thinking about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I should say that because I don't know, but I'm trying to guess.
Really specific.
Is it?
Yeah. Oh,
Jesus. No, you tell me then, because I'm thinking like after...
We met at a hospital singing Christmas carols for the Salvation Army.
Oh, my God.
You were bass, obviously, and I was tenor.
And were you brought in by Lisa?
Yes, Lisa.
A good friend, so Lisa
both,
Faulkner.
We'd both done shows with her, and yeah, she brought
That's
us
right.
in, and... Then we re-met at WAPA, obviously, because I was third year when you were first year.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so WAPA, you're both from Melbourne and travelled out west mm-hmm. for that wonderful program. Dean, what do you remember about Eddie at WAPA?
Well, nothing really because, I mean, we talked, but the third and first years do and don't interact that much. You don't get to see much of what they do, whereas the first years see a lot of what the third years do, and it becomes this kind of weird admiration / judgmental relationship. And it's always like, wow, their shows are so good, but we're better than them is kind of what revolved every year. So knowing Eddie a bit, and actually a lot of his year as well, I'd met quite a few of them before. So it was just kind of like a friendly thing, but I think you had a quite different experience of WAPA because you kind of changed a lot of what you did when you went there.
Yeah, because my biggest memory of Dean and Maddie Frank was when I first went to WAPA. I saw their production of Prodigal that they'd done, and it had a huge effect on me because I was just starting to write songs, and I got interested in writing for the musical stage while I was a student studying music theatre, and seeing that had a profound effect on me because there was these two third-year students with their own classmates putting on this musical, this amazing musical with incredible singer-actors, and I was like, holy smoke, they can do that. That's something to aim for. So that had a really big impact, and probably one of the reasons why I had the confidence to do it because I'd seen somebody do it before. I ended up doing the same thing in third year. I put on a piece of mine, which was kind of a song cycle based around the stories of interacting with the first year students. And
of which by then I think my brother Leon was in, because I think he was in that.
Leon was in that, yeah.
Wow, full circle.
Yeah,
very quick full circle.
Yeah, and, you know, I was same thing. I was given like a performance slot off to workshop and put that on, and I played. It was just piano and the class. You know, there was 18 people in every class. Mm. It was amazing. Just me on a piano, 18 students, just did this kind of showing.
One of who actually is in Vivid White, Verity Hunt Ballard.
So that's right.
I know, that's kind of weird that this is...
Wow.
Well,
yes.
It's actually Verity's second time being in one of your pieces of writing because she was in the Shane Warne...
That's right, in the musical.
...recreation at Hamer Hall.
That's right. And, it was the first time I had a feeling of going, oh, this is better than performing. Mm. It was a lot better than performing, and that was a really defining moment. So I've felt the same way ever since. My love of writing has escalated, and my love of performing has decreased.
For people that know nothing about Vivid White, they haven't read our little 50-word synopsis.
Mm-hmm.
How can you summarise what this story is about?
Well, this story is a social satire wrapped in the apocalypse. So it's two couples who are good friends discover they want to buy the same house and neither will back off. And it's about, you know, how whether a friendship can sustain the competitiveness or the loss of a dream. You know, you can't share a dream. Only one person can have it when it comes to a particular house. So while people are dealing with this social satire, there's also a kind of an apocalypse going on. So these people are trying to stay, you know, middle class for as long as they can within the apocalypse, and it all gets very messy and very weird. And it started as a play, and now it has a whole bunch of songs, which is
amazing,
which is kind of weird.
I read the script over the weekend for the first time, and I was cackling. Seriously. That often doesn't happen when you're reading a script with all the stage directions and page breaks. So it was really refreshing to actually laugh out loud so much. It is safe to say that it's set in a pre-apocalyptic or apocalyptic Melbourne.
It's in the changeover from, you know, no one ever writes about the changeover. It's either like...
it's coming or it's here.
Yeah, it's either coming or it's happened.
Well, apocalypses are always so instant in... I mean, part of what the play is a kind of, you know, a nod to disaster movies as well. But this is like a real disaster would be. Slow moving. No one's 100% sure if it's actually happening.
Yeah.
Whether it's a big enough deal to, you know, change your lifestyle at all or just kind of... have some vague plans for what will happen. And
well,
so,
it's because it's like, you know, and I'm really always interested in the bit just before, you know, the rise of Hitler and, you know,
fashion.
Well, you know, people are like, because no one ever knows when they're in the apocalypse and people are optimistic and, you know, like, and I don't think there's a single person that isn't looking around going, right now going, this is going to be all right, right? You know, we're not going to end up... We just don't know. You don't know if this is the apocalypse or whether this is just a blip. You know, I like the idea that, you know, middle-class Australians are so polite. How would they just sort of carry on, you know, in their routine and trying to be polite?
What and not, point like, sacrifice their things they're working towards. If you've been saving for a home, it's silly to just suddenly not buy a home because you're worried that the world's going to end. So you'll just keep going for that home. And
that's it.
You may as well renovate while you've got the home, you know, while people are still doing... while there's still tradies, you may as well, you know, make it look as you want it to.
Yeah. So it's kind of about the, you know, it's the frog in the pot of water, you know, like the heat is being turned up and the frog's not jumping out. That's really what the piece is about.
Why did you choose for your protagonist to be artists? And were there any real life similarities between the world that both of you exist in? Tell me a bit about that.
Well, they're both satirists, which is really important because I've spent, since I got out of college in 2001, I spent that whole time writing satire of one description or another, mostly musical satire. And then recently with The Beast, it was like, you know, a satirical play. Always comic. And so I've heard every criticism of satire you can ever hear. When you get satire really right and you totally nail people, they hate you for it. And when you kind of pull your punches, they hate you for it. There's a lot of stuff about, you know, what's the point of this? It's not going to change anything. There's a lot of pressure on satire for someone to sit in a theatre and watch satire and to feel like it's going to change the world, whereas every other style and genre of play and comedy doesn't have that responsibility. But satire is like, if it doesn't fix everything, if I don't change my mind and go and buy a hybrid car and, you know, and transplant my consciousness into a box and stop ruining the Earth's natural resources, what's the point of this piece, you know? So I wanted to explore what it's like with these two satirists in an extreme situation where the world is actually ending and they're like, well, what is the point? Well, the world they know is ending. You know, what is the point of satire? And in a way, to have a satirical piece, which Vivid White is, to have a discussion about satire and what responsibility the play has, what responsibility an audience has, whether satire can actually affect any change or do anything, whether it's supposed to. It's kind of very strange in that way. It's a satire about
it's satire. Satirized the satire, yeah. It is political and it comments a lot on status.
Yes, yeah, that's fair enough. It really is about taking, you know, the art perspective away. It's just about the competitiveness between friends, you know. Friends with means and friends without means. The way people see the world, the way people shape their own world and what they keep and what they discard, and about, you know, relationships. And houses are the lens through which we really compare ourselves to each other.
That leads me to ask, there are several references in this work that seem very well researched. Did you go to auctions and take notes, or how did this language come so naturally to you?
I have been to many auctions. So the auction scene was really fun to write, because I was just, you know, I didn't even, it's sort of there. I really love auctioneers. I love to watch auctioneers, because when they start, it's quite a theatrical job being an auctioneer. And when they start, they're all confident, because they're like, you know, this house in my mind is worth, you know, let's say $1.2 million. And you can see it. It's on the inside of them. They're pumped about it. They're going to sell this house. But a house is not worth anything if people don't bid for it. And there's nothing better than watching an auctioneer at an auction where no one bids. And they turn into this paper tiger, just a weird man with a contract and a tie, just pointing around going, anyone? And I love that, because I'm like, this is where you see the absolute fear of death. You know, my job is kind of meaningless. And so, yeah, that kind of dynamic is interesting. And everyone at my kind of, around me at my age, are buying houses, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's, everyone knows the pain. Everyone knows the suffering, and dealing with real estate agents and dealing with buyer's advocates and dealing with vendors and, you know, I've heard some shocking stories. It's all grist for the mill.
Beautiful. Well, Dean, a question for you. There are going to be some production elements in this that are technically very difficult, I imagine. So can you tell us a little bit about your approach to staging this work?
Yes. The first approach was delivering what Eddie had described, that I don't think he'd put a lot of thought into what it means in a three-dimensional world.
No.
And I actually think he was taking the piss from some of those stage directions. But I went, no, I'm going to deliver them, because, you know, this is theatre. And there was one, actually, that I wrote to him in a set of notes recently saying, Owen Phillips and I have decided that this is unachievable without blowing the budget. And he said, okay, cool, I'll rewrite. And then a week later, I went back and said, oh, no, I figured out how to do it now. Oh, it was so easy. Oh, it's great. And he's like, great, I haven't rewritten it yet. No worries. So that was kind of good. I felt like to be able to deliver a disaster movie on stage, the best thing to do is just admit you're in a theater and that it's all illusion anyway. It's not a movie where it's illusion in a different way on a much higher scale. It's illusion that has to happen in front of a theater audience each night. So, I think when I read the script first time, I thought it was really hard. And then the second time I went, oh God, I love how hard this is, because when are you asked and forced to do something this hard? So the approach I've taken was first to just work out whether I could do the hard things that were asked. And I think we've found solves for those. But more importantly, which is what you do on any play, is go, what is the world this needs to live in to even be allowed to live properly? So as you probably have gathered from the way Eddie's been talking about it, there's a lot of surreal stuff in the play, maybe absurd, whatever you want to call it. And Owen and I decided that the best way that that kind of weirdness works is if you ground it as much as you can in the real world as we know it, so it looks weird to us on stage. Because if the world's weird from the start, we're just like, oh, it's a weird world. It's Tim Burton. It's like, it's crazy. It's all crazy. Whereas if it looks like suburban Australia and then weird stuff happens within that, it's much creepier.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the David Lynch approach more, where you're like, well, this room's normal. Why do I feel so uncomfortable right now?
Well, yeah, that requires a really talented creative team, which you have assembled. Owen Phillips designing the set. Ross Graham on lights, and Tim Chappell doing the costumes, which is your Little Shop of Horrors ensemble.
It is. It's the same team from Little Shop of Horrors, which I think we were already in early discussions when that opened in Melbourne last year. And they are very different in a ton of ways, and they are quite related in a ton of ways. Just on a purely practical level, there's something like 9 realistic locations, and that alone in a theatre is difficult before you even add the apocalypse to it. So we've come up with a really cool, classy, colour-based design. As the title will tell you, White features heavily in the show, so we wanted to make sure that the introduction of White was a kind of surprising element. And yeah, it's kind of very elegant as it starts, so that as the world falls apart, our visual world falls apart as well.
I should mention too that Vivid White is the colour I painted my house, so inside of my house. It's like a Dulux colour.
I was going to ask. I thought it must be.
Yeah, and it was really... Like, you know, we were talking about what my wife Lucy got a Dulux colour consultant to come over to our house, and she was so funny because she presented us with a whole bunch. I walked in a bit late, and she walks up and she's like, "This is the kind of colour palette we're thinking of going for. We're thinking kind of like, you know, earthy, muted tones." And I was like, "Yeah, I'm not really into that." And she's gone, "Good, let's do this instead." And I was like, you know, like, I was like, have some integrity. So, yeah, it was kind of weird. But Vivid White is... when I was holding two colour swatches, one was white on white and one was vivid white. And I was outside and it was like it was summer. So it was like bright sun blaring. And I'm trying to look at two versions of white and in the sun. And I was like, this is so ridiculous. But Vivid White has... it has no other colour in it, no warmth of red, no coolness of blue. It's just
white.
And this is about white middle class people, yeah, ostensibly. So we're, you know, like Vivid White seemed like a good title. Yeah.
Well, it's going to be a very fun rehearsal room.
It's going to be really terrifying and really fun, I think, because there are just so many disparate elements to come together. Like, you know, when do you get to find actors that can play comedy and a range of instruments and sing really complicated harmonies? And yeah, it's going to be wild.
Vivid White plays at South Bank Theatre, The Sumner, from November 18th to December 23rd. To book tickets, visit ntc.com.au or call the box office on 03 8688 0800. This podcast is part of the MTC Talk series. To listen to more episodes, visit mtc.com.au or search for MTC Talks in the iTunes Store or on SoundCloud.